Dobrý deň, vítame vás pri počúvaní najnovšieho podcastu Ligy za ľudské práva Migračný kompas, ktorý je zameraný na tému migrácie, integrácie a azylu. Cieľom podcastu je zlepšiť informovanosť verejnosti a lídrov, ktorí ovplyvňujú nastavovanie politík. Séria má 24 častí, ktoré vás prevedú rôznymi témami od základných pojmov až po expertné analýzy prostredníctvom zaujímavých rozhovorov s odborníkmi v tejto oblasti.
Hello, my name is Zuzana Števulová and I am director of the Human Rights League and you are listening to Migration Compass podcast, a unique podcast of Human Rights League about migration and everything related to it in Slovakia, Europe and beyond. Today we will be talking in English because in the studio is with us Mohamed, our former client from Syria. Hello Mohamed.
Hi.
Welcome to the studio. We are very happy that you are here today with us. Please tell us something about you. You are from Syria. How did you come to Slovakia?
It's the same pleasure for me to be here with you. I actually came to Slovakia through the usual regular, or I can say irregular, Balkan road that crosses through Turkey, Greece, Macedonia, Serbia, Hungary being the first Schengen state after Greece, and from Hungary I ended up in Slovakia.
Mm-hmm. So it means that you didn't travel by plane or train or car or you didn't use a visa. Why did you travel like this?
The visa option is only available for those who have a passport in the first place to get a visa on it. That wasn't my case, unfortunately, because I couldn't actually obtain a passport from the Syrian government. That's why I had to leave the country illegally and continue the whole way illegally. As for the means of transport, I definitely did not use a plane, but I used train somewhere, I think.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. How was this experience to you?
At the time I was a bit younger than I am now, although now I'm not that old. I'm around 26, hitting 27 soon. But at the time I was around 22 or 23. It was 2015. I don't remember.
Student still.
Yeah. So it was more of a fun adventurous trip, I would say, more than something hard that I had to do.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually it was for a purpose that helped me reestablish my life. But at the time, like, going through the way, it was fun and adventurous.
Mm-hmm. Wasn't it scary somehow to cross the sea and to go to unknown places or states you haven't really thinking before to visit, probably?
I thought of it as I always crossed the bridge when I got to it. The very first step on that way is to take the boat to the other side of the sea in Greece. I think that was, the anticipation of it and knowing that you will be in the middle of the sea, although it's not that far from the shores, but still, like, knowing that it's not a distance that you can swim in case something happens, it was definitely scary. But that all disappeared once I was actually on the boat, mm-hmm. and knowing that I'm heading to the other side, which will take me somewhere.
Mm-hmm. So, and the reason why you took this road was not, I guess, about the adventure, although, as you said, it was adventurous, but I think you didn't really decide it for such a type of the road without having something behind you, right?
Definitely. That wasn't my case. I took that road to arrive to a place where I can legally establish and start over, I would say, because I already had my life started, but start over my life somewhere where I can enjoy legal rights of basically being and working and living as any other human being would do.
Yeah, because you couldn't do it in Syria, which is in war and was in war once you also left it, right?
Yeah, so going back to Syria, the main reason why I left Syria in the first place was because of the... it was because of the fear of prosecution of the government, which was and still common until the present time, I think, according to the news, at least. I haven't been there for a couple of years now. But basically, yes, at least in my individual case, the war wasn't the main factor, but the persecution for those who were involved in any political activity against the government was the main drive for me to leave the country in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
I know that I have many friends and relatives who weren't really involved in any activity or political activity in particular, but they left anyways because of the war, and I've lived these situations and I know how hard it was for everyone.
Yeah, we can imagine those stories about Syria have been in the news for many years now, and it really must have been really dangerous to you to stay there for any longer.
Yeah, I believe so.
Mm. So, Mohamed, how does it come that you eventually ended up in Slovakia? How did you come here?
Well, to brief you on this, I took the boat from Greece. From Turkey to Greece. From Greece, I crossed the borders into Macedonia. These are all land borders, of course, from Macedonia to Serbia. That was all smooth. Took trains and public transport. It wasn't really a big problem. Till I arrived at the Hungarian borders with Serbia, which was a bit of a problem, especially at the time the Hungarian government had really taken measures around their borders to protect.
So it was like around 2015 or something.
It was
like
exactly
that.
2015, mm-hmm. September 13th, when I crossed into Hungary. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it was actually the first day when they erected the defenses.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So you actually got lucky that you came through.
Yeah, I was actually lucky.
Mm-hmm. And what was going after that when you crossed into Hungary? What was your journey then?
I just took what they call a smuggler, which is basically anyone who has a car and ready to risk illegally taking people through the borders. Pay them some money to take me to the next Schengen state in... I've just decided to go through Slovakia because I thought it was just not the common road, not the road that everyone is taking. I thought it would be less crowded and safer.
Mm-hmm.
So I left the guy in Bratislava main bus station and I took a bus to Brno.
Mm-hmm.
And just before I arrived in Brno, in Czech Republic, was about... 10 minutes away from Brno, the whole bus was stopped by policemen. It was a police patrol on the highway, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the policemen came onto the bus and checked those who looked like they needed to be checked.
So not everyone in the bus, but just people he thought based on the color of the skin or appearance that they might be foreigners? Do you think so?
I don't have sufficient information about that, but it was definitely not everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it was only me and the bus who looked that needed to be checked. So basically no one was checked other than I was. Yep.
Mm-hmm. That sounds a bit of discrimination to me, but what was going on then?
I was found not to have a legal visa to allow me to enter Czech Republic or for that matter any other Schengen state. So I was taken into process in the foreigners police department in Brno city, which decided on my detention because I was scheduled to be returned to Slovakia since I entered Czech Republic through Slovakia.
Mm-hmm.
That was based on an evidence found with me. It was the bus ticket.
Yes.
Then I had to wait in detention in Czech Republic for exactly 37 days until the whole process was completed and the Slovak police agreed to take me back.
37 days?
Yes.
And it's a neighboring state.
Oh, yeah, but as far as I understood, there was some legal procedure to be taken, so yeah.
Mm-hmm. And eventually you were returned to Slovakia, right?
Yes, I was returned. Actually, I was kind of delivered in the police department of Holič.
Mm-hmm. So you couldn't actually walk on yourself through the border from Brno to Slovakia, but you were guarded by a police escort?
Yeah, definitely. I was escorted from some small town north to Prague in a police car to the borders with Czech Republic, where I was handed basically to police patrol of Czech Republic of Slovak Republic.
Mm-hmm. And what was going on after this?
I was driven to the city of Trnava to the police department, which eventually processed me and decided on my detention again. Then I was given a decision on detention for 3 months initially.
Mm-hmm.
it took them around 12 hours to complete the whole interrogation and procedure, and by midnight I was already in detention that day.
In Medvedev?
Yeah, in Medvedev.
Mm-hmm. But the police, they knew that you are coming from Syria, where the war was going on even at that time, right? Or was it not established?
Definitely they did, at least according to what I said and to the Syrian identity card I had on me.
Mm-hmm. So you were documented, you had the documents about your identity, so there was no mistake about where you are coming from.
I don't think anyone had any doubts about my identity, yes.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And in one of our previous podcasts, we had an interview with our lawyer, Katarina, who was describing to our audience how the regime in detention itself looks like and what is the legal procedure. So we don't need to go to talk about it right now. But Mohamed, probably our audience will be interested in listening from your point of view about the detention regime in Medvedev Center. What did you think and what did you feel about this being locked there?
Well, for every detainee, I mean, because I've met and lived with many detainees, I think for every detainee the background is very important. Me coming from Czech Republic, from detention in Czech Republic, at the time when I was detained in Czech Republic, I hated the place, hated everything. I mean, you cannot expect a human being to like being detained. But when I actually, when I was detained, when I saw how detention looks like in Slovakia, it was hell in comparison with the conditions in Czech Republic.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I'm saying, why I'm saying the background is very important, because if you were detained somewhere else, so you would compare it and you would wish that you have actually stayed over there.
Yes.
The time I walked in the detention facility, it was around midnight, as I said before. It looked very different from the detention I've seen, because it was all fenced. Like, you have there at least three layers of fences. One are higher than the others, and there are... it looks like maximum security facility, basically, once you're inside, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I was processed I was like stripped and searched and registered and all that. Then I was led by a policeman who took me to the main building of accommodation.
Mm-hmm.
Even that building where detainees actually stayed and spent their days was protected as if it contained criminals.
Mm-hmm. But you are no criminals because being crossing the land illegally is just a negligence, not a criminal act.
Yeah, as far as I understand. So everyone actually was wondering, like, why all this, why all these security measures and all that, making me think that I'm a criminal while I'm actually just a detainee who's waiting to be processed, whether deported or in any other way.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't really make sense to anyone. You wouldn't really believe that the number of gates and doors you have to cross in order to get into the main building.
Mm-hmm.
Which initially you coming after a whole day, at least 12 hours in the police department, hungry, interrogated, stressed. You don't really know what's going to happen to you next. So like, with all that, with all the tension you have in you, and you come and see all these doors at night, it's not really pleasant, and it
can be
scary.
For a person, to me, I would be totally scared.
Yeah, I think it was scary, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that it actually, all your transport from Prague or the detention center near Prague to Trnava police station, interrogation, 12 hours. So it lasted almost a day, right? So did you get any food or somebody explained to you what is going to happen? What is your position and the things like that? And did they somehow cared about you?
The only information I had about the procedure was from those who were detained with me in Czech Republic and then were transferred to Slovakia and detained. These people called us back to the detention facility in Czech Republic to tell us what happened with them in order for us to be prepared.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only heads up I had. Other than that, I mean, legally you would just be sitting or living where you live. Someone from the police would come and call your name. You don't really know what's happening. They'll try to tell you in any language that you might understand to pack your things. And you'll be led somewhere into a car. You don't really know what's happening. And I mean, maybe in the initial procedure, there is an interpreter who would tell you. But during the transport or before the transport, you don't really know what is happening. You're just told to follow and get in a car or leave a car, but you don't really know what's happening. And you're actually handcuffed during the whole transport.
Handcuffed even during the transport in a car?
To be honest, in Czech Republic, no, but in Slovakia, yes.
Mm-hmm. And I'm again mentioning that you are, and you have not been a criminal, but you have been handcuffed all the time. It's very strange to me. If I imagine that somebody can probably speed up the limit in the village and be handcuffed for 12 hours and led to nowhere or led to somewhere where he doesn't know where he will end up to, I think that would be really scary to any person experiencing this.
It is. I mean, me as a person in general, I fear not knowing my location, my geographical location. I really have a fear of that. So, yeah.
Yeah. And what happened actually when you were finally placed, locked in Medvedev detention center? How was the regime there and what was the behavior of the police staff around you? How do you remember about the time?
Well, basically, you have specified hours for meals, which is cooked by the staff there in the detention. And I'm just trying to describe how every day looked like.
Sure.
You would have to wake up the maximum by 8 in the morning to go down. I mean, you're basically forced to leave the main building and go to the canteen, even if you're not hungry or not willing to eat or any other reason. But you have to leave the place because the staff who cleans come in during the breakfast time and clean. And for that reason, for the fear of detainees I don't know, harassing or attacking the cleaning staff. Maybe that was the reason. That was actually the only reason I could think of.
Sure.
It would last around an hour in the canteen. You're still not able to leave the canteen to the garden or to the yard. Everything is heavily guarded. You wouldn't walk anywhere unless... You wouldn't walk anywhere without a policeman around you unless you're locked in. Then the same thing happens around lunchtime, which was 12 o'clock in the noon, and then for dinner around 5 in the evening. That's for the meals regime.
Did you have any possibility to kill the time by doing something or calling to somebody? Did you have any possibility to call to your family and tell them that you are basically somewhere safe, let's say?
So yeah, if you have any money on you, you would be giving 5 euros out of everything you have to be able to use them with the phone booth you have in the accommodation building. You have there only one phone booth for everyone who's living in that floor, because the main accommodation building for men is two floors. So each floor has its own booth, but it will be one. And at the time when I arrived, we were around 120 people sharing that phone.
Was it even possible to get on the phone?
I mean, yeah, the guys there were really nice. Like, you know, they know you're a newcomer and you need to tell your family that you're safe and everything. So they would definitely make the time for you at least to do that. the funniest part was that as a foreigner, I don't really have people around in Slovakia. I mean, it's the first time I stepped into the country, so... I don't have really someone who I can call within Slovakia, and that's the local or the domestic phone call that I can use the phone booth for.
So the phone booth is only for domestic calls, but you cannot call, for instance, to Syria or to your family somewhere else outside of Slovakia to let them know that actually you are alive.
No, actually it is, but you only have 5 euros, and I cannot imagine how much that would last you if you're doing an international call. So the workaround for this was to missed call someone from the number of detention and hope that they will call you back, which wasn't always the case. I mean, if someone missed calls me now from a foreign number, I wouldn't call back.
Sure. This is, I think, even advice that authorities are giving to citizens not to answer the foreign missed calls, because it can cost you a lot. So I can't imagine that I would do something like that, or I would receive such a call and I would just probably ignore it. Your family must have been terrified about your well-being that time, I guess.
Yeah, it was actually the case because I was like out of their radar for around 2 or 3 days at that time. So they were waiting for any call from a foreign number. That was the reason why they called back, actually.
Mm-hmm. And there is no access to internet whatsoever, or how is it?
I mean, technically it is possible. It's just a very long procedure. So you have this one day a week. It's like you have a window within the week. It's one day, I think it was Tuesday, where when you're able to submit requests to the administration. And that request can be either approved or declined. Depends on the nature of it and whether it's reasoned. So yeah, there was one computer device in the social worker's room, which is very far from the main accommodation building, and going there would need to be done in the presence of a policeman escorting you all the time. And I actually think that the the device there, the computer there, was provided by an NGO that was doing social working in that facility. But if you provide enough reason why you need to access the internet, for example, your family does not have a phone connection and you cannot call them for some reason, the only way is through internet, yeah, that can be possible, but it can take you at least 5 days until the social worker comes and your request is approved and everything.
I see. So you couldn't use your mobile phone if you would have any with internet connection whatsoever there.
No, definitely not. In fact, you're stripped of everything you own, even your own clothes, once you enter that facility and you are accepted. You even get the detention underwear. I mean,
even underwear.
Yeah, even underwear. Not really sure what's the purpose of that, but you don't even have access to your own civil clothes, keys, mobile phone, basically anything. Anything, yeah, other than a pack of cigarettes, maybe.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that must have been really hard. What were your feelings about Slovakia at that time? Because as far as we are talking about your stay in Slovakia at that time, everything you knew was probably the bus station in Bratislava for a couple of maybe hours, and then the police station, police car, and detention center in Medvedevo, right?
Yeah. Basically, right.
So what were you thinking that time in detention in Medvedevo about this country?
I mean, yeah, as you mentioned, the only things I have seen from this country is the horrible bus station that existed in Bratislava.
Luckily, being rebuilt.
the inside of a police department and detention, the few things I've known about Slovakia before I even left Syria was maybe the name of the capital and how the flag looks like. Wasn't really sure. There is this common information that like Czech Republic and Slovakia were part of the Soviet Union, which is not true, but it just makes people think that it looks like the USSR.
Sure.
And I mean, we don't have a. It's really complicated to explain. I mean, we in Syria can really relate a bit because we had a similar situation there. So we know how it looks like actually, or what kind of treatment you would get in a country that has this background.
Mm-hmm.
And all the things I've seen by then only confirmed the imaginations I had about the country.
So in fact your expectations were not high, and in fact they were actually met with not really high standard of treatment as far as we were talking until now.
You would think that joining the European Union would do some changes, some fundamental changes in how things go, but at the time I really didn't think so.
I can imagine. How much time did you spend in detention altogether?
Well, in total that was something around 6 months, maybe 14 days less.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, something around that.
That's quite a long time, I would say, to even hate this country. If it would be me, I must admit. But actually, maybe to step on more positive note, obviously you are not detained anymore, and you are sitting here across the table, and maybe tell us what happened after your detention.
So if we jump over all the details of how I actually got out of detention, so I decided to apply for asylum in this country, and I decided to stay. And once I actually left the detention and moved to Bratislava, things started to look different. I mean, not everyone is a policeman.
Obviously,
if we compare them, because I cannot also generalize that, like on all policemen. But I mean, most of them were not really pleasant people to talk to and deal with. So you would just think that everyone is like the policeman, but that is not true. People are just nice around, especially in Bratislava. I mean, you have kind of a international community here, that people are more exposed to internationals around. So it's not really that bad. It's actually great. I actually do like the place.
Mm-hmm.
It took me some time maybe to find a job, but I don't think that has anything to do with any of like these circumstances. But yeah, basically, it's a nice place after all.
I'm happy for that. But actually, let's come a little bit back to the asylum procedure. You said that you eventually decided to apply for asylum, but as far as I know, it wasn't that easy for you even after that to actually get the country to acknowledge you as a refugee, right?
Yeah, right. So I applied for asylum and got the minimum of that. It's the alternative when you don't get the actual asylum. It's called subsidiary protection.
Sure.
It's basically it allows you to stay in the country on a temporary basis, and that's what I got. The difference being is whether you have some fear of going back to your country of origin altogether or just temporary. It was really hard to get the Migration Office of Slovak Republic to grant me the official asylum status. It took me around 2 years and a half in courts to get that.
So 2 years and a half of the legal battle even after you left the detention center. I am actually amazed that you are still here in Slovakia and really happy for that, that actually you found the life here. Why do you think they didn't want you to grant you asylum at the first place? Do you have any opinion about it?
I mean, the opinion I have is that it looks like they just didn't want to. I don't really know what's the reason why they didn't want to, but it just looked like they didn't want to, because all the evidence was there, all the supporting evidence was there, all the legal opinions on the matter were there. And if they wanted to believe in all that, it was so easy, but they just didn't want to.
Mm-hmm. And what did change their opinion at the end? What was the main factor in it?
I think what changed all that is that we got, during one of the trials in the Supreme Court, I think we got some kind of a directive opinion from the judges on that case that wasn't really obliging to grant asylum, but it was kind of directive that this is the correct way to do it. And I think it would have been irrespectful for the Migration Office to disrespect that judgment.
Mm-hmm. So eventually the courts actually believed you and your story and your reasons and instructed.
I think that was always the case. Almost every time we went to court, the judges and the court actually believed me and agreed with me and didn't agree with the Migration Office. But mm-hmm. I was stuck in a legal loophole where the maximum that the court is able to do is to reverse the case back to Migration Office to reevaluate it. And every time that happened, Migration Office took the time and decided the exact same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that was basically what was happening, which changed after all.
Mm. And Mohamed, what were your feelings? What were you thinking during this time? Like, you were pretty young, let's say. You are still in your mid-20s and you had to fight 2 years and a half about your refugee status and the right to be granted asylum. What were you thinking?
Well, I mean, to be honest, I had mixed feelings. First thing I would think of is that, I mean, let's face it, I don't come from Sweden or Canada. I come from Syria. And I mean, what would I expect coming from Syria? I should be thankful that I'm getting a trial. But at the same time, I mean, you're coming to a country. I mean, it's the same law that when I was detained, I didn't have the option. And it was the same law that detained me. It's the same law that gives me the right to get asylum. So if I like if the authorities would agree with that law which detained me, they should also agree with the law that grants me the asylum. And it's all about that. So whether you believe that, yeah, you shouldn't get high expectations because you come from Syria and like it's fine whatever you get, but at the same time, like, you know that you left Syria for that reason. You don't want to live that kind of life, being persecuted and have nothing to do about it. I thought that I came to a place where these things do not happen, but as far as I could tell by then, these things still happened even within the European Union. So it drove me thinking, like, so maybe it's not that good after all. Yeah, basically.
Mm. And once you were holding in your hands the decision granting you asylum, what was your feeling? Did you feel satisfied somehow, or was it something else?
I mean, for over a week, I was still in denial. Once I got the decision, I really didn't believe that until I got the actual card in my hand. I still thought it was kind of a trick, or Migration Office will be doing something to revoke that or something. it's not about satisfaction, but I think it's more about justice. I felt that I had my justice. Because it was just a right that, according to the law, it was mine. It's just that someone doesn't want to give it to me. So I would say it's more of a just feeling.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, we can see from your story that there was a lot of injustice in your case, and finally, the granting of refuge and asylum probably somehow in a bit repairs it, hopefully, to you as well. Do you have any other, let's say, do you have any plans about the future in Slovakia? How do you think about this country now?
Well, especially when I'm talking about Bratislava, whenever I see the castle, especially coming from Austria, it just starts feeling like home. Like, yeah, I see the castle, I'm approaching Bratislava, soon I'll be home. It's the place that I know, the place that, I don't know, for God's sake, it's the place where shops are open on Sundays. You don't find that anywhere else.
some politicians would disagree with you.
Yeah, but I mean, really, like... Usually, when I'm coming back to Bratislava, it's usually from either Vienna or Vienna Airport or something. So I see the castle on the way, coming by bus or something, and I feel like, yeah, it's finally the place where I live. I know I have my whole life, basically. Even now, soon I'm going to visit my family, who. Like, they don't live in the flat where I grew up back in Syria. In fact, they live in Istanbul. And they live in a flat that I've never seen before. So I'm going to visit them. I'm thinking of it as I'm going home, because my mom is there and my mom is where home is. Mm. But I don't think it will be home, because, yeah, I'm going to meet my family, but it will never be home, because it's not the place I lived in. It's not even a flat I've seen before. So I think home will always be here where I live.
Mm-hmm. Do you think you will eventually live with your family again in at least one state, or close enough to see each other more often?
I think that will prove difficult. We're four brothers, and each one is living in a completely different country. I have one brother in Sweden, the other is in Germany, I live in Slovakia, and the fourth is in Turkey. So it would really take great odds for us to live in one state.
And probably would never be again a Syria, right?
I think that's out of consideration, as long as the current political situation is in place.
Well, Mohammed, thank you very much for what you have shared with us today. Our time is up. I am extremely grateful to you that you have been honest with us and really, really open about many things. There would be many things to talk more, but I think our audience who is listening to our podcast series would be really thrilled to listening to your story. Thank you once again for coming here.
Yeah, sure. I thank you for having me here, and I hope that would help give people more understanding.
Certainly. Thank you very much. This was Migration Compass podcast by Human Rights League, and my name is Zuzana Števulová. I am a director of the Human Rights League. And see you and listen to each other next time. Bye.
Podcast Migračný kompas je spolufinancovaný nenávratným finančným príspevkom z prostriedkov operačného programu Efektívna verejná správa z Európskeho sociálneho fondu. Podcast Migračný kompas je realizovaný Ligou za ľudské práva a viac o tomto projekte nájdete na jej web stránke www.hrl.sk.